to work, how do you get there? Do you drive, maybe spending hours in traffic, during which you are presumably listening to public radio? Do you take mass transit, like a subway or a bus? Or do you cobble together a mix of things? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're looking at a fundamental question of infrastructure. How do you make a transit system that people will actually take? Plus, stories about government secrets, and the time one of our listeners got a goat as a wedding present. Yes, really, a goat. You can share your stories with us on our website, marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are going to kick things off the way we normally do, by borrowing a couple words from the world of finance and asking our panelists to go long and short. That is, bet on or against some topics in the world of news and business. And this week, we have Jillian White, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Marketplace's own Jed Kim. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I think let's start with you, Jed. This is your first time on Long and Short. What do you have for us? What's your long?
Very excited. I am long on GMOs.
Really?
Yeah. It's very controversial, but it's not something that I think we're going to stop talking about for a long time.
Tell me why. Like, I think a lot of Americans are freaked out by genetically modified food.
Not just Americans, Europeans too. The whole idea of monster crops that we're genetically engineering and they're going to take over the world, it's just something that people fear. But looming above all of this is the projections that by 2050, we're going to be at a world population of more than 9 billion people. You know, how are we going to feed all these people? There's going to be less land that we can plant on. So there's just a lot of uncertainty.
And so genetically modifying some crops does what? Increases their yield? Makes it easier to feed more people with them?
Yeah, it makes some of them more resistant to fungus or pests, things like that.
Jillian, where are you on this? Are you one of those people who looks at labeling and says, oh, God, I'm not eating a GMO?
You know, I am one of those people who really tries to drum up the ability to care a ton about it, but just doesn't. Also, I feel like there's some other issues that we have with the things we're consuming, like Cheetos and Twinkies. And, you know, it's not like we're exactly eating the healthiest things in the first place. So,
Jillian, tell me about your long.
So my long is one that I think generally a lot of people can get behind. I'm behind greater access to credit, but more specifically, greater access to credit for low-income Americans. So I wrote a story this week that was about how when someone is unemployed, access to a credit card that is 10% or more of their annual income can give them about 3 extra weeks to search for a job. And that results in them finding better jobs at a pay level that is either exactly what they were making before or slightly higher, with at more productive and bigger firms. All of these things that, you know, just a little access to credit and not even necessarily using their credit cards gives them. It just gives them a little bit of a safety net. And that's kind of a big deal because there was a recent Fed survey that found that 39% of households that earn less than $40,000 a year didn't have a credit card.
Huh.
Yeah, and for households that earn more than that, that number is much lower. It's lower than 20%. So it's just the access to the safety net gives people the ability to live their lives and kind of boost their financial health in a way that poorer Americans who probably need it more don't have.
But isn't there some risk? I mean, we're now, what, 8 years out from the destruction of a massive credit bubble, that people could be pushed toward debt that they cannot pay off and that hangs over them?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think part of the reason that people fear access to credit, especially for lower income Americans, is the fear that they'll get themselves into these cycles of debt, right? But by withholding access to things like credit card, we're not necessarily preventing that. We're actually pushing people towards more dangerous, more high interest loans, mm-hmm. things like payday lenders, where they get stuck in a cycle of debt anyway at
right.
higher prices.
Yeah.
The issue is there is no good solution right now. There are no banks who are saying, here's $200 or even $2,000 at a completely reasonable rate, and you can borrow this to pay your mortgage or to pay your rent during a period where, you know, maybe your income is a little volatile. That doesn't exist.
All right, let's go to short. Jed, what are you short?
I am short on Captain America being a Nazi terrorist.
What? Okay, the what? But I'm not a Marvel person, so you're going to have to back up and explain
this to me. All right, so Marvel Universe, you know, one of their flagship characters, Captain America.
Wildly profitable. Okay.
It was announced this week that in one of their new comic storylines, it's going to be revealed that he is and always has been a double agent of this super evil organization called Hydra, which I think was a Nazi organization at one point. And so, you know, this is probably the most transparent ploy to sell books and shock readers that, I don't know, I've heard in a long time. The Marvel Cinematic Universe alone, you think of all the movies that come out these days, they're all Marvel. They've made, I don't know, some estimates put it at about $20 billion worldwide just for box office, not even DVD sales.
Yeah, I mean, I am with you on this. I am with you on this. People love Captain America, but because he's supposed to be the pinnacle of morality and patriotism and all these other things, and I do not think that anyone can stand or stomach the idea of him secretly being a Nazi.
I mean, I like the idea of him being a little dark because, to me, he's a little too shiny and nice, but this is this is kind of pushing it.
Jillian, what are you short?
So I am short making fun of millennials for living at home, and I know this is going to be so controversial, but Pew recently put out a study that said almost a third of young adults, so that's people between the ages of 18 and 34, are living with their parents or have lived with their parents at some point during that period.
I mean, as a Gen Xer, I enjoy making fun of millennials. I feel like it's one of the few benefits of being in Generation X. Mm-hmm. You know, things have not been the best for us. So if I can put a little superiority over my younger brothers, I feel great about that. But, you know, okay, fine. We'll just disagree, Jillian.
I mean, there are lots of reasons to make fun of millennials. I'm just saying this particular one, I think maybe we should ease up a little bit. You know, there are a lot of millennials who are living at home so that they can get their finances on better footing before they move out so they don't end up, you know, racking up tons of credit card debt. A lot of people have student loans. Some people are staying home and helping their parents out. You know, let's just be a little nicer.
But what will we make fun of them for?
Truly a host of other things.
True.
Whatever you want.
Jed Kim from Marketplace, Jillian White from The Atlantic. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Hi, it's Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening to Marketplace Weekend. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. Here's some context on us. Since we're a nonprofit, we rely on donations from our listeners to keep going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. Donate today at marketplace.org. The U.S. has resettled nearly 40,000 refugees since the start of the fiscal year in October. Despite the political rhetoric, only about 2,500 of them have come from Syria. Even so, the State Department says the U.S. is on track to accept the 10,000 Syrian refugees President Obama promised earlier this year. But when they do board a plane and make their way here, how does one family touch down in Sacramento while another ends up in Dearborn or Minneapolis? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson digs into the bureaucracy of what's called refugee allocation.
Mia Witte is sitting in a big conference room in New York with a view of the Hudson River. Bright green cardigan, big green eyes. She sets a handful of neon highlighters on the table and cracks a big binder.
91 pages this week.
With information of all the refugees that have been newly approved for resettlement in the U.S.
And it gives us the bare bones information of each refugee's case.
Nationality, ethnicity, religion, how many family members, whether they've been tortured, whether they have a medical condition, whether they know friends or family already in the U.S., each family becomes a case number, a row on a spreadsheet, their story a series of coded abbreviations. Witte points at one.
PA is principal applicant, WI is wife, 2MI is two minors, and then survivor means survivor of torture.
While abroad, these refugees have already gone through interviews, medical exams, security screenings, and now it's time for a new home. Every Wednesday each week, Witte, who works for Church World Service, meets colleagues from eight other agencies contracted with the State Department, and they go through and divide up that week's pool of refugees. It's a more bureaucratic version of picking teams on the playground. This particular week, there are more than 2,000 refugees ready for resettlement, about half of them Syrian. It takes 4 hours to divvy them up. To prepare for that meeting, Witte goes through the binder row by row with her highlighters. She starts with refugees who have a friend or family member already in the U.S. Generally, more than half do. That's one of the biggest factors in determining where refugees might be placed.
I never took geography in school, but this is making me an expert. Okay, so Phoenix, Arizona is the first case, Congolese family.
Church World Service has an office in Phoenix, so she swipes this case line with a yellow marker. Then she looks at how many refugees that office has already resettled this year and how many they've committed to but haven't yet arrived. That's the second big factor in determining who goes where, who can take them, and a little bit of who wants them.
So, for instance, our affiliate in Richmond, Virginia, they have churches that are interested in co-sponsoring single mothers. So when they don't have a friend or family member here, when I see that there is a single mother, I can select that case just knowing that we can send them to Richmond, Virginia, and that they'll be co-sponsored by a church there.
And it really just depends on that moment. You know, where is their availability to help them?
Larry Bartlett is the director of the Refugee Admissions Office at the State Department.
People might know about California or Florida or New York from overseas, but it doesn't mean those would be the best states for them to settle in.
Refugees don't get to choose the state or even the country where they wind up.
And it's actually an interesting issue because refugees really aren't in that way able to shop for a country that they think might be better. You know, Sweden has better social benefits than the United States.
It also takes the U.S. a year and a half to 2 years to process a refugee, screen them, get them ready to travel. That relatively long timeline means that if the U.N. has an emergency situation, they generally don't come to the U.S.
And our goal for this year is to achieve at least 10,000 Syrian arrivals, and we think that we're on track to do that.
That number is both too high or too low, depending on whom you ask. States like New Jersey and Kansas have tried to remove themselves from the refugee resettlement program. In November, more than 30 governors said they oppose settling Syrian refugees in their states because of security concerns following the terrorist attacks in Paris. But Woody says her networks are hungry to assist Syrian refugees.
There was just an outpouring of support from so many different people, so many different faith-based groups. And in the states where those governors were against them, people were coming out and saying, please send them here and we'll support them.
She says Syrian refugees are so requested, so in demand, that the 9 resettlement agencies used to limit how many each agency could select each week to make sure the Syrians were evenly divided. Woody says now that more Syrians are being cleared for resettlement, they don't worry about that as much anymore. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every day on our website, our By the Numbers blog finds the most interesting numbers and the stories behind them in the news and posts them. Here are Marketplace's Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner with a few of this week's.
Our first number is
10.8 million.
That's the dollar amount representing median pay for S&P 500 CEOs.
The Associated Press says the median for male CEOs is 10.5 million. For women, 18 million.
But those numbers are super skewed because of the 324 CEOs in the survey, only 17 were women.
100,000 to 150,000.
That's how many Pacific blue tang fish are brought into the U.S. every year.
You might know the blue tang better as Dory, the fish in Pixar's Finding Nemo and upcoming Finding Dory.
There's anecdotal evidence that clownfish got more popular after Finding Nemo came out, and some experts are now worried the same is going to happen for blue tangs.
You see, blue tangs have to be caught in the wild, and the fishing techniques can hurt both the fish and the reefs they live in.
30.
That's the percentage of Lego sets that come with some kind of weapon these days.
A new study from the journal PLOS-1 tallies them up, starting with the very first Lego weapons in 1978.
For the record, those were axes, lances, and swords for a castle set.
Right, but these days Lego licenses a lot of TV and film properties, so there's like laser guns, there's like regular guns, there's lightsabers, there's like Thor's hammer Mjolnir, and wait, what's that?
Oh, sorry, I forgot to turn off my nerd alert.
A couple of weeks ago, we started a conversation about wedding gifts. What you've gotten, what you've given. You had so many good stories that we have more of them this week, plus some bonus etiquette guidance from an expert. We're starting with Steve Snell, who wanted to add one very specific thing to his registry.
My wife took the lead on putting together our gift registry, and she put together a really good list, I thought, but there was just one thing that I wanted to add, and that was a salmon smoker.
Why did you want that?
Well, my friends up in Alaska had one, and I had spent the summer before up there with them, and I love smoked salmon, and I always wanted one. And most of the gifts that we were getting, I realized, were for hosting people, you know, like, so we had enough dishes to have a dinner party or something of that nature, mostly food related. So I thought a salmon smoker would be an appropriate addition as well. And it turns out that, you know, it's actually been one of the best utilized gifts, I think, that we've received. I've been able to make smoked salmon for parties. I send them out to friends and relatives as thank you. I'm pretty sure that's legal. I just mail it up in a bubble wrap thing and put it in the post, and then they can eat smoked salmon.
What does a salmon smoker run price-wise?
I think it's about $100. That was one of the first things someone bought for us, actually. Got to give a thanks to my older brother on that one.
Jean Braun and her husband got married at 23. They'd already been together for years after being high school sweethearts. She told us she felt pretty uncomfortable asking for gifts.
I've never been one to ask for things, especially if I don't really need them. And since my husband and I had been living together in our apartment, we really didn't need very much of anything. And so it was more of asking for kind of what we wanted. And even for like birthdays or Christmas, I don't like to say, oh, I want this. It's really difficult for me and for my husband as well.
So did you guys have a registry?
We did. I don't think there was more than 10 items on that registry. It was a stretch to even try to find something that we either wanted to replace that we had in our apartment already, or we just didn't have, but it was kind of a, this would be nice to have, but we don't really need it. So if someone wanted to purchase it, it would be a little extra for us.
What kind of advice would you give to someone who feels the way you do, who's sort of like, I don't know, awkward about asking for presents?
I would set up a registry, but I think a lot of the registry items people put up there are really expensive items, like dinner sets, and I think it's more of a couple's thing to do. So instead of having like big ticket items, have something that you know you'll use, not something that's just going to sit in a closet. And definitely keep the price down. I know a lot of people have big ticket items, hoping that a lot of people will come together to purchase them. And I feel like they don't really get purchased very often. So if you know you're going to have something that you really want, maybe have like a option on your registry to just send money.
For some of you, the gifts you didn't register for were much more memorable than what you asked for. Like this next gift, which has a name.
My name is Kelly Marshall. I'm 28 years old, and I'm from Duluth, Minnesota.
I was looking at the notes to get ready for talking to you, and I did a double take. You were given a goat?
Yes, we were. That was definitely not something we registered for. I teach riding lessons, and a family that I do lessons for, they also raise goats, and they had a little brand new baby goat when we were planning our wedding and getting registered for things. And I had gone over to their house to do a riding lesson, and I picked him up and cuddled with him, and he was just a darling little thing. And for whatever reason, the woman thought that he should definitely go home with me. So she surprised me and my husband with him as a wedding gift.
Wait, how does someone give you a goat as a wedding gift? Like, did you open a box and there was a goat in it? I really need specifics here.
There was not a box. Being that he's a goat, he probably would have eaten the box. So she kind of just called me up and said, hey, I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to give you this baby goat for your gift. And, you know, she didn't bring him to the wedding or anything. My husband was a little bit...
Is he still with you?
He is. Yes, he is. He's just turned 3 this spring. He's actually quite interesting. He's become a constant companion to a miniature horse. He kind of comes and goes as he pleases into the yard and on top of cars and wherever he wants to go. He's a great guard animal. I don't worry about the horses or the miniature pony at all. And we do have quite a few wolves and a pack of coyotes that skirt the property. So he's very, very good at keeping tabs on everyone.
One thing we noticed in these conversations is that people sometimes feel weird about wedding gifts,
We don't always know which rules to follow, what etiquette may or may not still apply. So for a little help, we turn to an expert who writes about this stuff, Washington Post advice columnist Carolyn Hacks. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
On a really basic level, is there such a thing as wedding gift etiquette in 2016?
Well, I should say yes, but I don't believe in it anymore. So, I mean, I believe in etiquette because it's the one thing that keeps people from having to guess and inadvertently offending people. But I think with wedding gifts, so much has changed and so quickly that right now it's a little bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're hearing from the people who have called us and written us. Do you get the gift from the registry or do you eschew the registry forever?
Well, I think you do whatever works for you. If somebody has a registry and you believe in buying something material, then go ahead and buy something off it. But I think it's a real challenge right now for people getting married because a lot of people aren't getting married at 21 when they have absolutely nothing. And the stuff that people use to stock a home is actually, it's dropped in price, relative price, for years. And so we have cheap stuff and people are getting married later. And a lot of people just don't want things. And at the same time, they don't want to offend their guests. So you've got this whole crossroads right now where people don't really want anything, but they're not supposed to ask for anything other than what's on the registry, which they don't even ask for directly. I mean, the way I look at it now is like the one thing you can't do is ask for money, and the one thing you should do is give money.
Well, you're going to have to explain that to me. I mean, you still have the kind of like, it's tacky to ask for money feeling?
Yes. Oh, I can't stand it. I can't say it. You just can't. I mean, everybody knows that it would be nice to have money, right? I mean, who doesn't want it? And even the people who absolutely don't need it and don't want it can donate it somewhere. It's beautiful. It fits everything, every situation, you know, it's universal. The people who want experiences can use it on experiences. The people who need stuff can use it to furnish their homes. And people who don't need it and don't want it can give it away. It's beautiful. But again, you can't ask for it because it's just incredibly tacky.
Well, then that puts people in a weird bind, right? I mean, why is our culture so hung up on this? I was talking to a Nigerian friend about his wedding, and he was like, oh, well, it's super normal in Nigeria to ask for and get money.
Right. Well, again, it's just, I think it's, I mean, maybe I'm just stuck on this one point. I really think your surrogates can probably say it for you. You know what? They could just get them a check. But I don't think you can say, give me money. I don't know. I choke on it.
We've encountered a couple of different views of the registry. Some people have said, oh, I put on there, you know, the things we might actually want every day and the things our friends could probably afford. And other people have said, well, gosh, this might be the chance to shoot for the stars and get the $400 sheet set that is beautiful. And if someone springs for it, great. Where do you come down on that?
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the, hey, if people are going to buy it for me, I'll take it. But I think one of the ways that you can inoculate yourself against doing the wrong thing with a registry is keep it streamlined and provide a good range. So if you've got somebody who can only spare $25 on something, have something there. And if you have people who are looking for something big, then have something there. But it's sort of like the key to life is just if you're not sure what to do, just tell yourself, okay, don't be a jerk. And I think if you're putting together your registry and you just have that little voice in your head saying, don't be a jerk, you could probably come down in some sort of range of acceptability.
Does the fanciness of a wedding or, say, the lengths that a bride and groom or bride and bride, groom and groom have gone to, does that influence at all what you give?
Oh, no. Is this the you have to cover the plate question? That's another one that drives me bananas. The idea that
well,
the gift has to equal.
Is that a going theory?
Well, some people really believe that. I've actually gotten mail from brides or grooms who are really offended by a gift because it didn't even come close to covering what they paid for the catering for that person to come. And I'm thinking, oh, that's just so mercenary. First of all, wedding gifts are not required. Any gift is a gesture of generosity. It is not a requirement. And that's rule number one. And that's where I do believe etiquette has a place. Etiquette says gifts are never required. When you do give a gift, you give based on what you want to give somebody and what you're able to give somebody. And that's it. It has nothing to do with the hospitality you've been shown. The hospitality is what the bride and groom want to give, and the gift is what the guest wants to give, and that's it. They're independent.
Carolyn Hacks, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Since it is Memorial Day weekend, we need your help solving one of life's greatest mysteries. How do you successfully travel with children? And what are your tips for pulling it off? Or maybe you didn't and you have some horror stories to tell. You can give us a call at 1-800-648-5114 or leave a note on our Facebook page. Just search for Marketplace Business News. No matter who you are, you've probably had a rough day at the office that changed your perspective. Or maybe you made an impulse purchase you really, really wish you could take back. This week, we sat down with Allison Mosshart and Jamie Hintz from the band The Kills and had them fill out our questionnaire inspired by experiences with money and work. It's called the Marketplace Quiz.
Hey, I'm Allison.
I'm Jamie.
We are The Kills. Okay, Jamie, I want you to fill in the blank, okay? Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
Well, I mean, it can buy you a car to drive away from the misery. And it can buy you a house and live somewhere else away from the misery. And surround yourself with things that make you forget the misery. In the next life, what would your career be?
I would like to be a detective.
Yes, you'd be a fantastic detective. Yeah. She's so good. Agent Mohair, we call her.
All right, Jamie. When did you realize music could be an actual career?
Well, in some ways, I'm yet to realize. Not, you know, just because... I'm saying that in a way because I don't like to think of it as a career. I don't like to. I like to think of it as the thing I'm doing. And I think if you start thinking of it as a career, you start doing some pretty silly things. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the first time was when I got first record deal I got, and we paid. We were actually got a wage. It was in my first band, and we were earning 150 quid a week each. What? What is your most prized possession?
Probably my car. My Dodge Challenger with a Hemi in it is my favorite thing that I've got. I care for it very much and, hand wax it and hand wash it and vacuum it all the time. And I talk to it and it talks to me. And no, I love my car. It's nice. It's a vehicle of freedom. It's good. Okay, Jamie, what was your first job?
My first job, I worked in a hotel. Washing pots, washing up in Hungerford. It's this little town that's famous for nothing except this guy called Michael Ryan, who went on a shooting spree and killed everybody. That's what it's famous for. I worked in a hotel there, and I had nothing to do with that. But I worked in a hotel there. I was like this little punk rock kid, and I was vegan, and I was really into like Flux of Indians and Crass and all that. And I sort of sold all these, you know, these older kids that work in there that was vegan, because you sort of want to swap your kind of your cultural beliefs and things. And they locked me in the meat freezer. So I left. That was like 4 days. Something you do. What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Everyone should have a passport. I think everyone should have one of those.
I think so, too.
So you can go places, and you don't just stay home all the time. Learn things, see things, do things. All right, sorry my answers are rather short. I wasn't locked in any locker.
It's all right.
Yeah, we're a good team. Okay.
You know, you're my antidote. I talk too much. You don't talk enough. Will you call on me if I turn my back on you? Fall to the river. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started? Wash your face.
Brush your teeth.
Yeah. Drink more water.
Before I started what?
So you, you know, started being in my band.
Oh my God.
No, I don't know. Before you started music.
Oh.
I wish they'd tell me not to be so worried. You know,
worried.
I was
about
really
what?
Worried in the early days of playing music. Just so worried about a lot of things, you know. Really worried about it. Stopped me doing things sometimes because I just worried. Felt like, ooh, I can't do it. What if? And all that. And I just, that seems so stupid now to have been worried.
Yeah, I mean, I was rather worried when I first started playing on stage, much before I met you. I wouldn't look at the audience. I would stand behind things and I couldn't.
When they rehearsed in her first band, she used to get a really long mic cable and, like, be in a different room to
I
the
drag
rest
it
of the band.
Under the house, like, in the door of the house from the garage to a bedroom, yeah, go in the bedroom and lock the door and sing from there. I couldn't even hear what they were playing, but I tried. They kicked me out of the band, obviously.
Yeah, where are they now?
That was The Kills. Their latest album, Ash and Ice, comes out next week. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. This week, I've been working out of our office in downtown Los Angeles. And like any good East Coaster, when I'm here, I want to go to the beach. But ugh, the traffic. Except now, tourists like me and people who actually live here can get to the beach via the metro. That's the public underground and above ground train. And as of last week, for the first time, riders can take it all the way to the beach in Santa Monica on the newly expanded line. The expansion cost $1.5 billion, and it's getting a lot of attention in a city where the public transit system is often kind of a punchline. But here's the thing. Transit systems all around the U.S. wrestle with one big question. What makes people decide to ride instead of, say, driving or biking or whatever? We decided to ask some regular people and someone who studies this. We also tried it. Our sound engineer Daniel and I took the train to the beach, and our producer Eliza drove.
We are in downtown Los Angeles. We're going to get on the new line and try to race Eliza to the beach with the 7th Street Metro Center, and it is 10:39 a.m. Let's do this thing.
The first person we met along the way was just visiting.
I'm Claire, and I'm from Australia.
So why are you taking the train to the beach?
Because we wanted to go to Santa Monica, and the staff at our hotel recommended that we do it this way.
Because?
It's new. Everyone's really excited about it, apparently. Is that true?
It just opened? That's what we're trying to find out.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, everyone at our hotel is. Apparently it just opened, and not many people have tried it yet, so we're giving it a go.
And why do this versus, say, rent a car?
We are renting a car, but not until tomorrow. We heard it's $70 to catch a taxi out to Santa Monica. So we thought $7 for a daily pass versus $70. We'll take the train.
So we're kind of hanging out on the platform now. Just a nice little clock thing that tells us the train's coming in 2 minutes. Ooh, look at that. There's an ad now that says more to explore with pictures of the water and the Ferris wheel at the Santa Monica Pier. I guess they want people to use this line.
The train does come 2 minutes later. It's blue and white inside, clean and pretty quiet. And for some of the commuters on board, it's part of their daily routine. I'm going to let this guy introduce himself.
Clifford.
And why are you taking the train today?
I do it every day. That's how I get to work.
And why take the train instead of driving?
It's better, for several reasons. You don't have to stress over parking and the environment, the environmental impact and things like that. I can read, I can do my work, make contact with the rest of the city for real, you know, real people, all those things.
About halfway through our ride, I got a text.
Eliza just texted us at 11:05, and she's already there. She put an obnoxious little celebratory emoji on it, too.
We, on the other hand, still had a ways to go. Henry Miller ended up on the train for the first time today.
My car broke down, so I'm catching a bus to go pick up my car. I had to drop my daughter off in school in South Bay.
Is this your first time on the new line? What do you think?
My first time, period. Yeah, it's great. It's great. Smooth, pretty fast. I like it.
Would it make you think about maybe taking the train instead of driving?
Well, yeah, I mean, certain days, yeah. I can do that certain days. I think it'd be great. And plus, I like the route that it goes to, straight to the beach. That's fantastic. That's going to be good for the summer.
Would you yeah, I mean, you mentioned you have a daughter. Would you take her to the beach?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because we're not too far from the Culver City Station, so we can ride our bikes. And they have, like, a little bike trail along the way, too, so it's pretty cool.
I guess the question that we're trying to answer overall is kind of what it takes to make people use public transit on a regular basis. What does it take for you?
I think the convenience, closest to where you live, you know, like that. I mean, something like this would be fantastic. My wife is talking about doing this instead of driving to catch this to where she has to work. So, you know, if I was a stable place, you know, like a brick and mortar place, then definitely this would be nice because the traffic is insane. 5 o'clock, west side, it's too bad. It's really bad over there. So this is great.
We finally got to the Santa Monica station a little under an hour after we first bought tickets. When we met another new rider, Christine, who was almost palpably excited about the train.
I rode it Saturday, and I was so excited. I got off at the 17th Street station on the way back because I love food trucks. And they also had a lot of the Metro information that I needed for seniors. Because I go to senior meetings, I live in the Palisades, and I'm trying to collect senior stuff for them, like the map, so we can all do a day excursion. They are so excited.
So you think it's going to be a regular thing for you?
Yes, it is weekly.
Eliza beat us to the station by about 35 minutes. But weighing the pros and cons of taking the train is not all about the speed.
All told, it took you 20 minutes, maybe? It
took me about half an hour.
What was it like?
It wasn't bad. The traffic was not that bad. It was the end of rush hour. I was driving through downtown, through mid-city and Culver City, and there were slow parts. There were some aggressive drivers. I was engaged the whole time. But it was an easy drive today. There are times I could imagine that you would have beaten me here.
What would it take to make you take the train?
Not much. I'm actually really jealous of the people who took the train and don't have to pay for parking in Santa Monica right now. Parking here is hard. Parking downtown is hard. Parking all over LA is hard. And if you take the train, you don't have to worry about it. It's nice.
The beach is only a couple of blocks from the station, but instead of spending our afternoon there, we went to talk to someone who can put all of this in context. That person, Brian Taylor, studies urban planning and transportation nationally, because we're talking about a huge economic issue, not just in LA, but in cities all around the country. Building, expanding, or adapting public transportation systems can be a really big lift in terms of both money and politics. And sometimes just maintaining a transit system is even harder. We sat down with Professor Taylor. He directs the Institute for Transportation Studies at UCLA. And he said that our interest as journalists in this new metro line here in LA is actually a symptom of people focusing on the wrong thing when it comes to transit.
So there's a tendency we have in general to focus on the big new capital projects and not really think about it's really the day-to-day operations, the connections, that rail line has to connect with all the bus service and things like that. It's those things that make the difference. But voters don't get very excited about that.
No.
So you can talk to most transit operators and they'll say, oh, I can get money for a new rail line, but I can't get any money for operations and maintenance.
It's interesting to me to see LA get excited or parts of LA get excited about this new light rail line when I look at these older systems, New York and D.C. being my primary examples, and they're doing things like catching on fire on a regular basis or...
The catching on fire is exactly what I talked about, how there's money for new extensions of Metro in Washington, but not much interest in maintaining the existing system, right? So there's a whole scandal with inadequate maintenance on that.
One of the things I found interesting was reading a comment. You said that the idea of having light rail doesn't reduce traffic.
Let's think about the great transit cities in the world. Tokyo, sure. Mexico City, New York, London, Paris. They're all characterized by very low levels of congestion, right? No. No, they're not. So this is a show
I was
about,
like, wait.
This is a show about business.
Yeah.
Okay. So What happens? What does public transit provide in a congested area? It provides an opportunity to get around by means other than driving. It gives people choices. So if you're in Manhattan, there are many ways to get around. There are opportunities to walk to things nearby. Think about suburban Houston. In suburban Houston, basically, the only way you can get around is by car. It's also very congested, but you don't have choices in how to get around. So if we think about something like the Expo Line, what it does is it adds another choice to the set. You now have an ability to get around to another place. Now, what we would say is that the world is better off because now more people are getting around. But in the absence of some price on the road use, the time cost of travel goes out, which lowers the price, which encourages more people to consume it.
And so it's really just supply and demand, basically.
It's supply and demand. And what it is you're broadening the supply.
So we've talked about new projects. I want you to explain to me why there isn't more money or drive to update existing systems. After all, the metro in D.C. really does catch on fire.
Well,
that seems egregious.
One of the big dilemmas we have with public transit is that the vast majority of transit riders are in the centers of the oldest and largest metropolitan areas, and it's extremely low elsewhere. So we think about New York, we have huge numbers of transit ridership. We think about Tulsa, Oklahoma, it's relatively small. Okay? But politically, representation doesn't work that way. So what we're doing in some places, we're building light rail lines in Sacramento, California, and in Miami and places like that. When investing more in New York and in Chicago, San Francisco would get you more in terms of riders. So that's one thing that goes on. Then within metropolitan areas, the same logic applies, is that most riders are either in places where it's difficult or expensive to park, or where incomes are very low and auto access is low. In what we find, though, is that selling this is an important redistributive social service, saying we're providing mobility for people without, doesn't get very far with voters.
Shockingly, upper-income Americans are not buying that logic.
Right. So when you say, though, hey, we're going to help clear traffic, people will support it. Now, somewhat ironically, the main way we've been supporting new public transit service around the country, and particularly in California, has been through sales taxes, and sales taxes are very regressive with respect to income. So you have a problem is that a lot of these new services, which are increasingly oriented toward commuters, are paid for disproportionately by low-income households. So we have this unusual situation where it's more expensive to serve high-income riders than it is low-income riders, and we're using a relatively income-regressive tax instrument to pay for it. So in many ways, there's a lot of equity issues that are raised by the way that public transit is funded and consumed.
What would you do? Let's say I make you the Secretary of Transportation.
What I would do is move away from general instruments of taxation for transportation. I wouldn't use sales taxes and general fund transfers. I'd have people pay for the transportation they consume. I would change the way that we price public transit so that it's much cheaper to make short midday trips and more expensive to go in the peak hour and the peak direction. I would discourage local governments from mandating free parking around new developments to encourage sort of the market to charge for parking more so that people who drive have to compensate society for the costs they impose on it. Doing all those things would suddenly make using public transit much more attractive in many places. And then if we had more locally funding of these, it's likely that we'd get fewer federally funded projects in outlying areas where they're unlikely to realize a lot of benefits. And we'd probably be investing a lot more in those big cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, and others where ridership really can operate at a high level.
Brian Taylor, thank you very much.
Sure.
Years ago, reporter David Yanofsky, who writes for Quartz, wanted some data from the U.S. government for a story.
I was working on a story about Disney and the number of Brazilians that travel to Orlando.
It seems pretty simple, right? Who comes to the U.S., when, where, why? It turns out this data is held by a wing of the Commerce Department, which gets it from Customs. David did what reporters often do. He asked for the data under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. Instead, the government said, nah, you can't have it, but we'll sell it to you. 5 years of statistics for $173,775. Information that could tell us a lot about immigration, tourism, and our economy, but is only available to those who pay. David Yanofsky is now suing the Commerce Department for free access to the data, and we brought him on. David, why does the government charge for this information?
Because they can. Because companies are willing to pay. To a large hotel group or to anyone in the tourism industry, this tells them who they need to market to. They can look at this data and see what are the growing demographics. How many 18 to 25-year-old Japanese men are flying to Las Vegas in summer? That's what you can find in this data, but only if you pay.
Maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I find it fascinating that this data resides with the Commerce Department, because to me, that signals that the government sees its mission in controlling this information to sell it and to promote it to hotels and tourism companies and what have you, as opposed to we're holding on to this for national security purposes.
So the data does start with Customs and Border Protection, and it is collected almost automatically when a foreign national shows up at the border. And that record on an almost monthly basis gets transferred to the International Trade Administration, which is tasked with promoting trade and development and working with businesses to do that. But I look at it, the fact that it's part of the Commerce Department shows how essential it is to stimulating growth in the United States economy and how important it is for business owners and anyone interested in investing in the U.S. in any way to understand their customers. In the same way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has thousands of metrics on employment situation or prices, these are all essential metrics that business owners and consumers should know and need to know to have a successful, thriving economy here.
Are there other databases that you know of that the government is selling in a similar fashion?
It's hard to say. I asked them, do you have any record of how much money the government gets from selling data or reports or anything? And they're like, nah, we never looked into it. We don't have anything. In my own looking of trying to find high-priced databases, especially ones that have been attempted to be released through FOIA, didn't find any.
Why sue?
It's the only recourse we have under FOIA. We submitted the request. We were denied the request. We submitted an administrative appeal. We were denied the administrative appeal for a different reason than we were denied the initial request, which is not uncommon, but it's also concerning. And then after that, you either have to let it go or you have to take it to court.
This is, by the president's own proclamation, the most transparent administration in history. Do we know if the decision to sell this data is new? Does it reside with the Obama administration or does it go farther back?
From everything I can tell, the sale of this data is status quo going back for decades or more.
When you think about this suit, what kind of precedent could it set? I mean, say you lose.
If we lose, that'd be bad, or it'd be unfortunate, especially for open data efforts and for journalists looking to access any information of this kind. You know, we are definitely hoping for an outcome that gives us access to this data for free and establishes a framework for which similar things should happen. But, you know, it's a lawsuit. Anything can happen.
Does this mean that any data that the government wants to hide could be put behind a paywall?
That's apparently the argument that the government is making in their responses to my FOIA request. We'll see what they say in court. But they say that they have an authorization to charge for this data, and therefore it doesn't have to be released through FOIA, which, taken to its logical conclusion, would mean that the government thinks that all they need to do to subvert or avoid FOIA requests is to put a fee on it.
David Yanofsky from Quartz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we want to know, how do you successfully travel with kids? Have you pulled it off? Also, let's hear those horror stories about the times it didn't work. Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez and Ben Tolliday are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao.
Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.